Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. On Wednesday, Russia began launching airstrikes in northern Syria, and this is dominating headlines. 19-year-old Omar Kaysan told today's guest, reporter Borzu Daragahi, quote, "We are used to Syrian planes. They hover for 5 minutes or more before they carry the raid out. But Wednesday's raid was quick and sudden. It was surprising. There is usually an alarm that goes off in the town that allows people to hide in the shelters, but not this time," end quote. Hassan al-Arraj, a doctor who was treating casualties, told Daragahi that there were no ISIS fighters in the area. He said no rebel fighters died, only civilians. Daragahi reports that strikes mark the Kremlin's first major intervention in a distant foreign conflict since it invaded Afghanistan during the Soviet Union's dying days and began just 2 days after Vladimir Putin met President Barack Obama in New York. So how are the media covering the role of outside forces in the Syrian civil war? Borzu Daragahi is BuzzFeed News Middle East correspondent, and he'll be joining us in just about 30 minutes. And the Syrian civil war dominated discussions at the UN General Assembly meeting in New York this week. There were three versions of why Syria is in such a tragic state. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani blamed the 2003 invasion of Iraq for the creation of ISIS. President Obama blamed Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, and Russian President Vladimir Putin put the blame on the West's support for the opposition. So after all that is happening to Syria and the Syrian people, how should journalists report on what is happening as various parties try to shape the narrative? Jonathan Landay has been covering the meeting at the UN. Jonathan Landay is national security and intelligence correspondent with McClatchy Newspapers. He has written about foreign affairs and U.S. foreign policy for 15 years. Hi, Jonathan. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. And Afghanistan is making headlines after the Taliban captured Kunduz, a major Afghan city. This is the first time this has happened since the U.S.-led invasion in 2001. L.A. Times reporter Ali Latifi reports that the Afghan government is reporting that it has regained control of Kunduz, but the Taliban are denying those claims. He also reports that on Wednesday, the U.S. military launched airstrikes and rushed special force advisors to Kunduz as the Afghan army struggled to retake the provincial capital. Ali Latifi is the L.A. Times special correspondent in Kabul, Afghanistan. Hi, Ali. Welcome to the show. Ali, are you with us? Well, we're trying to reach Kabul, so we might have a problem. We'll call him right back. Well, as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that really stood out. So, Jonathan Landay, what stood out for you this week?
What stood out for me, really, was the total paralysis within the so-called international community over what to do about Syria. And it's that gap into which the Russians have now inserted themselves. It was amazing to listen to leader after leader of major powers and minor powers, and the Secretary General himself of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, all of them saying, "We haven't done anything. We need to do something. We need to get off our butts and get a peace process moving. We have to do something about this terrible refugee situation." With Ban Ki-moon saying the international humanitarian system isn't broken; it's broke. In other words, there's even no money left, or very little money, not enough money needed to address not just this massive tidal wave of refugees flowing into Europe, but the millions of refugees who are stuck still in Turkey, in Iraq, in Lebanon, in other places within Syria itself. And just this utter paralysis, as I said, where you have this all of these leaders saying, you know, "We haven't done anything," and then blaming each other. And you could hear the divisions that have paralyzed any kind of concerted, coordinated international response to the tragedy of Syria. Then it becomes very clear why there hasn't been this. And all of this taking place on the 70th anniversary of the founding of the United Nations, an institution that was supposed to bring together the international community in a diplomatic setting and so that you could come up with a diplomatic solution as an alternative to war, and it was quite clear from what I saw this week at the United Nations, that the institution is not functioning. It's not working, at least with regard to Syria and a host of other problems like Yemen and what's going on in Iraq.
And so, Jonathan, we're going to talk about this later in the show, but you were at the UN covering these issues and these speeches by these leaders. Where did you see good reporting on this? And what questions were reporters asking these people?
Well, you know, it's really, I mean, I think that everybody seemed to get in their reporting was able to convey this paralysis. If you're a good reporter, and I think there are a lot of people who are able to do this, if you're a good reporter, that's what you highlight when you're also writing about here's what Putin said, here's what Obama said. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not going to point you at one particular story, but generally I think a lot of the journalism was able to pinpoint this utter paralysis that has that is the United Nations.
Jonathan Lande has been covering the meeting at the UN. He is National Security and Intelligence Correspondent for McClatchy. A little later in the show, we'll talk more about that. And I believe we now have on LA Times reporter Ali Latifi from Kabul. Hi, Ali. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Hi, thank you for joining us. So, Ali, on our Friday Media Roundtable, we point out journalism that, did a good job this week, or journalists who've done a good job this week. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
That's a good question. I think, there has been a lot of really good reporting by Radio Free Europe, by DPA, the Deutsche Presse Agentur, by Deutsche Welle, and hopefully by the LA Times, about the issues in Kunduz in Afghanistan, which was basically the first city this week on early Monday morning. It was the first time that the Taliban were able to take over a city, a provincial capital, the fifth largest city in the country. It was the first time in 14 years that they were able to do this, and I think the reporting on it has been very difficult because of the fact that the city is basically shut off from people. It's very hard for anyone to get there. A couple of friends of mine, they went. One went and he basically didn't get a chance to get out of the airport. Another went with one of the security services and he said he didn't get to go into the city. So the issue with reporting on Kunduz and the thing that I think that like RFE and Deutsche Welle and DPA have been good at is sort of parsing, the different accounts, because even the people in the city, this is now the third or fourth day, they've run out of food because, stores are afraid to stay open. They've run out of electricity's in and out, cell phone services in and out. They've run out of credit on their phones. So it's very hard to get information from there. But people are still trying, and we're seeing a lot of, really good reporting coming from it. And I think what separates good reporting from just sort of the okay reporting out of Kunduz is sort of parsing the two, because you will get accounts from the government and human rights organizations saying one thing, and then you'll get other accounts from the Taliban and the people on the ground saying something else. And sort of trying to put those together and say, be truthful, like there are conflicting reports, we're not 100% sure of, every element of it, but this is what all of the different parties are saying. Because there are a lot of parties getting involved in this issue and become, because we heard, when was it? It was the other day, it was on Wednesday, when they were saying, basically, we've taken over the city, right? Like, when the government was saying, we've taken back control of the city. It was Wednesday night going into Thursday morning saying, we've taken back control of the city. And, it's back in government hands. But then if you talk to people, I was talking to people on the ground too. If you talk to people, they say, yes, to an extent, it's in government hands, but people are still afraid to go out. And also there are parts of the city that are basically still divided between the two sides, because the government was trying very hard to say, we've taken it back, it's ours, it's not an issue anymore. But the people on the ground, they can still hear gunfire. There's still fighting going on in certain parts of the city, even until now. And even where there isn't necessarily fighting, they're afraid to go out. They're afraid to go out on the street.
And Ali,
and so
for people
kind of,
For people who haven't been following this closely, again, the Taliban captured Kunduz. This is a major Afghan city. This is the first time this has happened since the U.S.-led invasion in 2001. This is a city of 300,000 people.
Right.
And according to the United Nations, more than 6,000 people have fled the city. According to reports, several hundred Taliban fighters were able to take over the city. How did that happen?
So the thing is that, you know, Kunduz has been, so the Taliban every year, they have what they call their spring offensive, right? Which starts, with, I mean, it depends when it starts, but this year it started in April. And they have been concentrating very much on the north, you know. Usually they were able to grab a lot of power and sort of take over a lot of areas in the east and the south. But this year they were trying very specifically to target the north. And we've seen throughout the past year, you know, districts in Kunduz, in the province of Kunduz, in other provinces like Badakhshan, we've seen them fall to the Taliban and then back to the government, then back to the Taliban, then so on and so forth. So this has been a goal of theirs for the entire year. Kunduz city, the province and the capital share name, has been sort of been their prize. It's what they've had their eye on this whole year. Now, specifically how or why it happened, there's a few different theories. One is that, you know, there was a lot going on in the few weeks leading up to it. In the east, there was issues. In the south, there was issues, which was taking a lot of attention away, I think. The other thing is that in Kunduz, so basically when the foreigners started to withdraw in 2014, one way that the government made up for that shortage was basically by enlisting local militias, right? So they had, and Kunduz is one of those places that has between 4,500 and 10,000 armed men that run these different militias. And now these militias, some are connected to the government, some aren't. You know, some are answerable to the Ministry of Interior, some are not. And they do operate against the Taliban. They are very much against the Taliban. But what happens is a lot of these militias are led by strongmen that abuse the people. You know, we've seen cases of land grabs, of physical abuse, of intimidation, of rape, of basically going to people's houses and saying, you have to join my militia, to all of the young men. So this created a lot of resentment among the people for the militia. So if you feel like the government is supporting the militia and the militia aren't doing anything for you, what is your next best option? The Taliban. So there was a level of people that you know, wanted the Taliban to come. I'm not going to say a lot or the majority, but there definitely was a certain percentage of the people that wanted that to come because they felt like it was a way to get away from the abuses of these militias and a government that they feel like isn't paying attention to them. So these were two issues. And then the other thing is I talked to a security official and he said when the government, after all of this happened, the government forces took over the airport. But he was saying even in the airport, there was a lot of disorganization because, as you said, they just weren't prepared. And so this is part of why this process took so much longer to regain the city, is that they weren't prepared. They weren't looking out for it. And that's become a big question is why weren't they prepared? You know, some of these militiamen were not in town when it happened. Actually, one of the most famous ones was allegedly in Tajikistan. And there was also, you know, there have been reports of Kunduzi people helping the Taliban. So again, this comes back to disenchantment with the government and the militias that they are either directly or indirectly supporting.
And that is Ali Latifi. He is an LA Times special correspondent. He's joining us from Kabul, Afghanistan. We're also joined by Jonathan Landay, national security and intelligence correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. Jonathan, you have also reported from Afghanistan. What are your thoughts on the significance of this and the difficulties of reporting what's happening? Amnesty International just came out with a horrific report. Amnesty officials spoke to mostly women who are leaving Kunduz. They're talking about mass murder, gang rapes, and house-to-house searches by death squads.
So as you just heard, you know, I've spent a lot of time in Afghanistan, beginning with the Soviet occupation, which kind of dates me. But yes, you know, Kunduz is way up in the north. It's quite far from the centers of power in Kabul and other places. And we have a new leader of the Taliban, Mullah Mansour, who replaced the now departed Mullah Omar. And his ascension was disputed. And so here we have this major offensive that that would count towards, if it's a, even if they get pushed out, it's a major blow struck by the Taliban, which would give enormous credibility, a huge boost in credibility to Mullah Mansour, and perhaps stabilize his leadership of the Taliban and end the dissent, end the challenges that he has faced to his ascension of the Taliban. That's one of my major takeaways. The other one is this big question of how did this happen? How could this have happened without without some kind of intelligence warning when they're assembling these very large numbers of men? Well, they had intelligence, but nothing was done. I mean, there was no effort to preempt this, where the Taliban was able to put together these large numbers of men and stage not just the assault on Kunduz, but they have been staging ambushes along the highway to Kunduz that Afghan security troops forces have to take to reach the city and regain it. And so they've been able to stall those advances by Afghan security forces. There are Taliban offensives going on in other districts of the north. We just this morning I've seen news that the Taliban have taken over the district in neighboring Badakhshan province. And so it's a major challenge to the government in Kabul, which has had a pretty serious time getting its act together because it remains riven by these rivalries between President Ghani and the chief executive, Abdullah Abdullah. And so, you know, this is something else that the Taliban is taking advantage of.
What about the internal and international policies? The Washington has provided almost $6 billion to the Afghan government this year alone, including $4 billion for the military. That figure adds up to about $100 billion since 2001. And, of course, that doesn't include the human cost of the invasion and occupation. Jonathan, what are your thoughts on that and how that's being reported?
Well, my thoughts are that but there's not a lot of reporting going on here. There aren't a lot of Western news organizations that are based still in Kabul and that are covering a conflict in which the United States is still very much a participant and still has troops on the ground, albeit as advisors and special forces. So as for the coverage, kudos to those organizations that still maintain bureaus in Kabul, and there aren't very many, there's just a handful of them. But beyond that, you know, the fact is that neither the United States or anyone else has really devoted the kind of resources, in terms of troops and numbers, that would be needed to pacify a country the size of Afghanistan. That's the first problem, and that's been a problem from day one. The second problem is the greatest flaw in U.S. policy towards that part of the world and anybody's policy towards that part of the world, and it's called Pakistan. I mean, the fact is that the Taliban have been allowed to continue to use Pakistan as a launch pad, as a sanctuary, as a place where they maintain their leadership, their leadership circles. And Pakistan is still very much a country that is essentially whose foreign policy is very much run by their military. And their military still see Afghanistan as a place that they are in competition with for influence with their their traditional enemy, India. And so that equation has not changed. Beyond that, the Pakistanis, you know, they've had this ongoing offensive in their tribal areas in the northern Pakistan where the Afghan Taliban have leadership have been based. And the Afghan Taliban really have not been targeted by that at all. They've been going after the so-called bad Taliban, the Pakistani Taliban, but not the Afghan Taliban. Mullah Mansour is still based in Pakistan, and the fact is that there still remains a huge problem for any effort by any country, whether it be at the United States or in its European allies, the government of Afghanistan itself, in trying to resolve and resolve this insurgency and stabilize the situation there.
Jonathan, does McClatchy have a bureau in Afghanistan?
No, we don't. We closed ours. It's both a function of the fact that the United States, the U.S. troop drawdown, the lack of which reduced popular or Americans' interest in the place. I think there was a war weariness anyway, but it's also a function of the problems that the newspaper industry in general is still wrestling with that began, in 2007, 2008, and with the advent of the Internet and how, no one really has been able to figure out, no one in the print media or in the media world in general, how you monetize advertising on the Internet. Mm. And so it was a financial question as well.
And Ali, are you working with any foreign journalists?
In what sense?
Well, are there many foreign journalists in Kabul where you are?
Yeah, there are some. The Guardian, the Washington Post, DPA, the AP, South Bureau, Reuters, Wall Street Journal. But we have to remember that a lot of that work, the actual work, is done by the Afghan journalists. They are the ones that will interview people. They are the ones that will most likely go out into a lot of the scenes that will, a lot of the content comes from them because it's as simple as a language barrier or, as simple as can you get in a car and drive to Badakhshan, when you have blonde hair and blue eyes or when you can't speak the language. And going back to what the previous guest said, I had written something about a blog about this a while ago. There was, I think it was BuzzFeed wrote something about like the future of foreign journalism, and the author was working for the Washington Post at the time, and he said the future of foreign journalism is something like, one time the Washington Post had a story, something like five things you need to know about Syria, but you were embarrassed to ask. And he said that sort of like sound by, very succinct and very straightforward kind of journalism is the future of the foreign bureau. Mm. And I sort of posited a different example, which is, empowering, the Afghan journalists in that are working for you in your bureaus, so that, you can help them so that they obviously speak English, they obviously write English, but getting it to the point where, they can write even a simple news story, without much editing and can take over, because then that leaves a legacy because we've seen, the NPR bureau closed last year. We're going to see other bureaus close soon, too. And so instead of closing the bureau, why not hand it over to your local, to the Afghan staff, because, we always have, Westerners coming and reporting on China or Afghanistan or Pakistan or wherever. But how often, is someone from China going and reporting on New York, or someone from India going and reporting on Boston or London?
Right.
I absolutely
need to reverse.
I absolutely agree with everything that Ali said. NPR closed its bureau. We shared the compound with NPR when we closed our bureau, and I fought, to try and at least keep, whenever I would spend weeks at a time. We also had somebody based there permanently, but I would always try to, work as closely as I can with our Afghan staff to teach them, to show them how to, I'd sit them down with me when I was editing their stories. I'd make them write as much as possible, and I absolutely agree. We need to empower journalists who have a much better understanding than the nuances of the country and their culture than people like me.
And Jonathan, hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break. That is Jonathan Landay, national security and intelligence correspondent with McClatchy, and Ali Latifi is the LA Times special correspondent in Kabul, Afghanistan. Ali, thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for your reporting.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And this is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW, local public radio. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, it is our media roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. Jonathan Landay is national security and intelligence correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. He has been covering the discussions at the UN General Assembly meeting in New York this week. The Syrian civil war dominated those discussions. And now I would like to welcome back Borzu Daragahi. He is BuzzFeed News Middle East correspondent. He and two colleagues recently wrote a piece called What's It Like to Be a Syrian Civilian Under Russian Bombs? Hi, Borzu. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
It's nice to have you. Borzu, just before the break, we were talking with Ali Latifi, who's in Kabul, Afghanistan, talking about the importance of local reporters on the ground. And you've been on the show many times talking about how you rely on local people. And talk a little bit about what it's been like for you to report on what's happening in Syria and the importance of civilians on the ground in helping get the word out about what people are dealing with.
Well, yeah, I mean, as many people already know, you know, we rely a great deal on activist journalists inside Syria. But, you know, lately it's been a lot very tough because there's just been a propensity to exaggerate, to propagandize. And so you have to really carefully vet the information. Generally, when I'm covering Syria, because I, you know, have not been able to get into Syria, it's been very difficult to go inside Syria in any capacity. You generally are sitting with preferably a Syrian speaking translator, but, you know, possibly an Arabic speaking translator, and sitting together and working on the phone. I want to hear, because I understand quite a bit of Arabic, I want to hear the interviews. I don't want to do Skype text. I don't want to do WhatsApp. I want to hear their voices as we're talking to them. And so we get in touch with them via phone, via Skype, via other electronic kind of apps, Viber sometimes. And, you know, you just try to assess the information as best as you can, try to match up the information with videos that appear. It's somewhat of a painstaking process. But if you get lucky on certain days and throw enough manpower hours at it, you can come up with a good report, good vivid details about what happened somewhere.
You've got a number of damning, horrific quotes in your latest piece. 19-year-old Omar Kaysan told you, "We are used to Syrian planes. They hover for 5 minutes or more before they carry the raid out. But Wednesday's raid by the Russians was quick and sudden. It was surprising. There's usually an alarm that goes off in the town that allows people to hide in the shelters, but not this time." You also quote a doctor who was treating casualties, Hassan al-Araj, and he told you that there were no ISIS fighters in the area. He said no rebel fighters died, only civilians. So when you hear things like this, how are you able to confirm this?
Well, I mean, that claim that there were no ISIS fighters there was rather easy to corroborate. I mean, just because, you know, the mapping of Syria is being done painstakingly by numerous organizations in terms of who controls what territory. And there is no ISIS near any of the spots on that day, at least. Today was a little different. On that day, there was no ISIS where the Russians bombed. And as for the claim that there was only civilian casualties, you know, this is a contact that is very much trusted. This is someone who's proved reliable. I mean, there was only civilian casualties. The claim was made by someone who we've talked to before. We had his last name. This is someone who's, you know, proved his trustworthiness in the past. And so, you know, we take it at face value. Also, you know, something important to know, when rebels lose fighters, they generally lionize them and, you know, sort of post pictures of them on their websites and social media outlets, canonizing them as martyrs. And there was no such canonizations. There was only pictures of kids being wrapped up into bloodied blankets.
Mm. Borzu, were you surprised by Russia's decision to start bombing targets in Syria?
You know, I'm not a Russia expert, but I kind of was surprised for the simple reason that it just seems really stupid to me. Maybe short term you get like a quick adrenaline shot, but I'm just thinking, you know, I would love to hear what Jonathan has to say about this too. He's an old friend. You know, I'm just thinking of that first Russian pilot that's captured by ISIS and put in an orange jumpsuit and beheaded live on YouTube. Or that first truck bomb that drives into the Russian airbase at Latakia and kills 30 Russian soldiers, how that's going to play in Moscow, how that's going to play St. Petersburg, how that's going to, you know, work in Putin's favor at that point. So I was surprised only because it just seemed like really, really, really dumb.
Jonathan, what about you? Were you surprised?
Well, I was surprised at the decision to deploy, but once the deployment began, there was no question what the Russians were going to do. You know, I covered the last 4 years of the conflict in of the Russian occupation of Afghanistan. I rode out on the first Russian armored convoy to leave Afghanistan, and there are many differences, but there are these parallels too. You know, I think the Russians went in to Syria, have gone into Syria with the same intent as they went into Afghanistan, to stabilize the government in power. We saw what happened in Afghanistan, where they had, you know, thousands of boots on the ground. They do not have that in Syria. I think the ground forces are largely going to be not just the Syrians, but I think the Iranians, as well as Shia militia that are being sent in from Iraq, and places we already know that they've got militia in there from Shia militia in there from Afghanistan and Pakistan. The question, though, is to what degree can the Russians sustain this over the long term? In the short term, they may very well be able to achieve their goal of stabilizing those areas that are controlled by Assad, and then I think the next step is to, and what they're doing now is going after it looks like they've gone after a few ISIS areas today, but primarily I think their goal is to wipe out or at least severely wound the groups with which the United States and the West writ large might be able to work in terms of getting a transitional authority put together that can take over from Assad. The Russians, the Assad government, the Iranians want to take that option completely off the table, and you do that by going after those groups and you kill them, or you force them basically to go and join the Islamic State or some of the other Islamist groups that are not going to be reconcilable to a peace settlement, and you secure that area, you secure the north-south axis from Aleppo down to Damascus down to the border with Lebanon, and that's kind of what you secure for Assad, and you say, okay, we've got him secure now. He has to be a factor in any kind of peace negotiations. In the short term, maybe that'll work, in the medium term, maybe, but I don't see it working in the long term based on my experience in Afghanistan. I mean, it's a recipe for constant fighting. It's a recipe for constant war, and I would like to – I mean, unfortunately, I'm not an Arabic speaker, but I'm willing to bet that on the jihadi social networks that the call has gone out. We all have to get together now to go fight the Russians. I would not want to be the Russians on the ground in Syria, and I would hope that Mr. Putin has taken steps to secure Russian embassies in the Middle East, and even in his southern flank, where you have insurgency going on in the southern Caucasus. I mean, there are a lot of those people, Chechens in particular, who are fighting in Syria. I think he's going to have some trouble. He risks having trouble at home as well. And so, you know, maybe, as I said, in the short term, he might be able to secure, to achieve his goal, his apparent goal. But in the long term, it's deeply uncertain where this is going to go.
Jonathan Landay is national security and intelligence correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. He's written about foreign affairs for 15 years. And Borzu Daragahi is BuzzFeed News Middle East correspondent. Today on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we are discussing coverage of what's happening in Syria. We'll also talk about coverage of how this is affecting the Syrian people. And what strikes you about the coverage? Russia is now dominating headlines because it started bombing Syria on Wednesday. What questions do you have? What are your thoughts on how this is being reported? There's basically, you know, various parties are trying to shape the narrative of this. It's very polarizing. So what are your thoughts about the propaganda coming from various sides and how reporters are dealing with that? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So what about that narrative, Borzu, and how reporters should deal with it? Because you talked to so many people who said there were no ISIS fighters in this area, no rebel fighters died, it was only civilians. Russia is denying this.
People that we I mean, it's not just people that we talk to, but I mean, there are actual experts and policy analysts in Europe and in the Middle East and in Washington and other places, researchers, academics, who spend their whole day mapping out who controls what in Syria. So, you know, we know where ISIS is. We know where Jaish al-Fatah, which is the coalition that includes the al-Qaeda-linked Jabhat al-Nusra, is. And we know where Ahrar al-Shams is, which is a jihadi group that's backed by, more moderate than the other groups, that's backed by Turkey and Qatar. And we know where the FSA are. You know, they all have Facebook pages. They all have Twitter feeds. So, you know, and we all, you know, there are people who map these things out. So it's not just us listening to those claims. It's people who've been covering Syria for a few years who kind of know what they're doing. And, you know, I wish more people would sort of, you know, at least somewhat trust us on that kind of stuff, instead of thinking that everything is sort of a conspiracy and that, you know, facts are basically non-existent and they can just sort of make any kind of conjecture and accept any kind of analysis because no one knows what they're talking about with regard to Syria. There are actually people who know what they're talking about.
Jonathan, what are your thoughts on that?
I would agree. You know, I was in Syria twice last year. I've been focused on the Middle East for many, many years. And I was actually in Syria twice last year. I had visas that were given to me by the Assad regime. I spent time in Iraq. So I would agree with Borzu, and we have very seasoned people who have been covering this thing now for 4 years. We have a Syrian reporter who is involved. He's based outside of Syria but has extensive networks of contacts inside. Borzu was talking about that. You were talking about kind of the messaging and the coverage. I think it's important to contrast what we are reporting in the West and the Arab and a lot of other people with what's being reported in the message that's going out in Russia. My colleague Matthew Schofield, who's based in Berlin but watches that area and including Russia, has filed a story about kind of the way this is being portrayed inside of Russia by the largely state-controlled media there. Let's not forget that there isn't much independent media left in Russia. But I mean, what they're saying, the way this is being cast is that Russia and President Putin are the only people left who are willing to fight the worst evil in the world, and that the Europe has forgotten its roots, and it's being overwhelmed by these hordes of refugees, and the United States is responsible for all of this. And I just quote, it's really interesting, a political scientist who wrote a piece on the pro-government website Izvestia, a political scientist by the name of Svetlana Luri, writes the following, quote, "We live in a new reality. We are fighting a new evil called Islamic State, an evil the West decided not to confront. The West is lost. Our step forward is an expression of great courage and responsibility. We have to accept this responsibility. There will be consequences, maybe severe ones, but we took this decision." Talking about Europe being a sad American lapdog, which, quote, smells of unwashed human bodies, unquote. And so, you know, they are, you know, they, the Russian media is presenting Russia as being the savior of Western civilization. Let's not forget also that the patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church has declared this a holy war. I mean, cast your mind back to when the United States was getting ready to invade Iraq, and the former President George Bush called this a crusade. Well, that wasn't really the right message you want to send to that part of the world. Now the Russians have, and I think that they could find themselves in very serious trouble.
Bloomberg has a piece out today, Putin hailed as humanity's savior as Kremlin PR machine kicks in. And according to this piece, Putin has control over all national broadcasters in Russia.
Exactly, and so, you know, that's exactly what my colleague Matt Schofield is reporting. It's the way the Russians are portraying this to their people. But, you know, I think that one of the things that we need to examine is kind of how long Putin and his machine can continue persuading the Russian people of this. Putin has essentially lost in Crimea, in eastern Ukraine. That is a conflict that has suddenly just completely died down. We have peace talks today going on in Paris between Putin and the leaders of France. I think the German chancellor, I don't know if she's there, but he has a huge financial bill now that he has got, that he's been saddled with when it comes to eastern Ukraine. He has got international sanctions on him that have hurting his economy. This is Moscow's first foreign military intervention since the invasion of Afghanistan. It's not something that is going to on this scale, because you can talk about what happened actually in Georgia and Ukraine as well, but nothing on this scale. And this is going to cost him a lot of money. And when Iran's oil comes online in a big way as a result of the Iranian nuclear deal, you're going to see oil prices go down even further. So the question is, at least economically in my mind, how is Putin going to be able to sustain this at any reasonable pace and keep his people fed?
Borzu, what about reporting on the other players involved? There are also reports that Iran is sending in troops to Syria.
Yeah, that was just like, it was like one really, really lousily sourced Reuters report that Iranians have denied. We should just be very careful about anonymously sourced people in the Middle East giving claims. I was shocked that Reuters would report that. No one else bothered to match it even. So no one, it's just one report. I wouldn't be surprised if Iranians send some proxies there. I'd be very doubtful that Iranians would send ground troops, maybe advisors, maybe special operations people, special forces, but never own ground troops and so on. So I would be very, very surprised at that. One thing that's very interesting is Jonathan was saying that the jihadis are probably thirsting for blood on the social media websites. But it's not just the jihadis that are going to be thirsting for blood. Even Saudi Arabia is extremely angry over this escalation by Russia. And you can bet that they're not going to let their allies in Deir ez-Zor or in Homs or Hama or Damascus, in the suburbs of Damascus, just perish at the hands of the Russian Shia, Iran, Iraq, Hezbollah axis. You can bet that they're going to start upping the flow of weapons and money to some of these groups. So, just because Russia may gain like a little bit of a tactical advantage over these first few days and weeks, because the other side, the rebels, weren't expecting it, doesn't mean that the rebels aren't going to adjust as well. And I wouldn't be surprised if you started seeing something that the U.S. has been preventing from entering the field here into the battlefield. I wouldn't be surprised, and there's been a bit of speculation that I've seen, that you're going to start seeing man pads, that is, shoulder-fired anti-aircraft weapons, start entering the theater here and being used against these Russian planes that are bombing bread distribution centers, for example.
And I would absolutely agree with that. I would, on the sidelines of the UN, did a meeting with the Saudi foreign minister, Adel Al Jubeir. And, he said, look, there's only two options now that can happen in Syria. One, a political settlement without Assad, or two, a military solution, which will take longer. And I pointed out to him, I said, the last time Russia was involved in invading a Muslim country, your country, Saudi Arabia, had a huge hand in arming the opposition, and that would have been Afghanistan. I said, do you intend to do the same? And he said, looked at me and he said, no comment. And that was kind of, a little bit dire. Even if the Saudis themselves officially don't start pumping in weapons and more weapons and more money, they could turn a blind eye to the private donations, the private money that is certainly going to flow towards the opposition to go after the Russians. Look, the Muslim world has not forgotten the 10 years of the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. They have not forgotten what the Russians did in Chechnya and Grozny in particular, and that was under Putin the second time. And so there is a lot of there's a lot of fuel that is going to be thrown on this.
Jonathan Landay is a reporter with McClatchy Newspapers, and Borzu Dorogahi is with BuzzFeed News. He's a Middle East correspondent. Let's hear from Ruthann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruthann. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thanks for having the show. I wanted to ask if either guest had heard of or read. There was an article in the London Review of Books last month that was addressing that, notwithstanding how horrific ISIS is in terms of beheadings and all of the things that we all know about that the Western media is extrapolating on, is that they are really similar to the way Hamas was working in the West Bank and Gaza, that they were providing infrastructure and that police and all kinds of things that the citizens could have more reliably than under a different government, that they were providing a lot of positive infrastructure and stability.
Borzu, do you want to take that first?
Sure, yeah. I mean, you know, in areas that they totally control, such as Raqqa and Mosul and other parts of Iraq and Syria that they totally control, they have taken up the reins of government. They have taken up the reins of service. But these were already services that were there. And, you know, I think it's important to point out that, you know, incredibly, both the governments in Damascus and Baghdad are to some extent continuing to pay the salaries of civil servants in those areas. You know, for various reasons, mostly humanitarian reasons. So the money is actually coming from the central government to the people in those areas. And it's kind of complicated how the money gets there, but it's actually happening. And I think it's also important to point out that, you know, this is one of the things that distinguishes ISIS. This was one of the main sources of the fights between ISIS and the other rebel groups that led to this massive rift, you know, whereby you have all the rebel groups fighting against ISIS, against as well as Bashar al-Assad. ISIS was always about establishing itself as a state and, crucially, collecting taxes and collecting monies in the areas it controlled, whereas the other rebel groups were content to receive money from foreign donors. And this was always the main source of contention, and this is perhaps the defining aspect of ISIS versus the other Syrian rebel groups and the other Iraqi insurgent groups, was their pretensions of being a state, and this was primarily a financial difference with the other groups.
Jonathan, do you have anything to add?
No, I think that pretty much covers it. Borzu would know better than I, because he calls in and talks to people, but I'm not sure that the people in the areas that are quote-unquote administered by the Islamic State are very happy with the way they're quote-unquote being administered. Sure. I've seen reports of people, you know, let's not forget they're being administered through no choice of their own, through violence, through the threat of violence. There are public executions, that kind of thing. It doesn't sound like a very nice place to live to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like, you know, there was no services or no institutions before, you know. I mean, oftentimes what you have is like a school, and ISIS goes and paints the school black and says, okay, now this is an ISIS school. So not exactly, yeah, exactly, especially in a place like Syria that has a tradition of, you know, rather progressive, moderate Islam, as well as other kinds of different sects and a certain level of multicultural, multi-confessional aspects. You know, ISIS does not really fit into the culture of that country.
Well, thank you for calling in, Ruthann. We have just a few minutes left, and I just wanted to spend these last remaining moments talking about the civilians and how people are being affected by what's happening here. Borzu, what are your thoughts on the story that needs to be told from here on out and how the people are affected? I mean, the refugee crisis is continuing. We're doing a show about that on Monday.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, this is the root of the refugee crisis, and we keep forgetting that, you know, what is happening in Syria is a horror movie. I mean, it is a terrible, terrible situation. We're talking about families, you know, sometimes middle class, living in a decent state. Maybe dad is a civil servant. Maybe, mom works in the private sector. All of a sudden, bombs start hitting that part of the city where they're living, and so they move in with a relative somewhere else. Then perhaps that area gets consumed by the fighting, by rebel and government fighting, and so then they leave again and live, for example, in a town where they don't know anybody, but some friendly people take them in. And then all of a sudden, perhaps ISIS takes over that village, and then again they're displaced. This time they go somewhere and they sleep on the floor of a mosque. They've lost everything at this point. Maybe one or two members of the family has already been killed or captured or pressed into service by either the government or the gangs. And, this is the situation that people find themselves in when they show up at the Turkish border asking for help and asking for services. So this is what's happening in Syria to the ordinary people is really the problem right now. And that is really what is driving the refugee crisis, what is driving the instability. This has become a global security issue that, people need to address. And I think that they are starting to address this. Mm.
Jonathan, 30 seconds. How is McClatchy covering this crisis?
We've got a bureau in Istanbul manned by a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, Roy Gutman. We have a Syrian journalist there who is assisting him. I am helping out from here. As I said, I've spent time in the area. We have a very good American Arab reporter who has spent a lot of time in that area, Hannah Alam, who covers the State Department. And so, and then we have people in. Oh, and then we have an incredibly good reporter in Idlib in Iraq, Mitch Prothero, who watches Iraq for us, but also is doing a yeoman's job covering Syria as well. He did a really good piece yesterday on how that there's another objective here of Putin's, which is the Chechens who are fighting with the Islamic State and other groups in Syria who threaten his security if they are ever to return to Russia.
Jonathan Lande is national security and intelligence correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, and Borzu Daragahi is Middle East correspondent with BuzzFeed News. And thank you both for joining us.
My pleasure.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the Syrian refugee crisis. Since the outbreak of the civil war in 2011, 11 million Syrians have sought safety in neighboring countries. The worsening crisis is getting more attention as hundreds of thousands of people are trying to enter Europe. What is the dignified solution to this crisis? And who should be held accountable for this calamity? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Debbie Kennedy is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.